From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the very first day of October 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. Later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Bruce Bostard, the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. In agricultural news, the Federal Reserve may need to take further steps to boost growth in the United States. Merrill Lynch analysts think oil prices could average $83 a barrel next year. And USDA says it may update its just-released small grains survey in the November crop production report. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories shortly, and then he'll be back a bit later in our program during the Farming World. He'll talk with Joe Prasaki of NASS about yesterday's reports. Stay with us for that if you can. If you can't, you can always pick it up on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. Just look for the Closing Market Report. By the way, the Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
Taking a look at the numbers as they settled up in Chicago on a Friday afternoon, a day after the USDA reports things fall apart. December contract in the wheat at 655, down 19 cents. March at 688 and a half, down 18 and a half. The May at 703 and a quarter, down 15 and a half. But it's the corn pit that was sharply lower, down the limit. In December at 465 and three quarters, 30 lower. The March at 478 and a quarter. The May at 484. And July corn at 487 and a half, all 30 cents lower. Next year's December contract did not lose 30 cents. That contract was down 20 and a half at 460 and three quarters. From the bean pit, the news wasn't a lot better, down 49 and three quarters, if you want the market to go higher, that is. $10.57 the settlement price. January at 1066 and three quarters, down 49. March at 1075, down 47 and three quarters. And the May at 1078 and a quarter, 46 and a half lower. And next year's November beans at 1043 and a half, down 41 and one half. October meal down $16.40. October oil down $1.21. Livestock numbers settled up the October at 95.95, down 75 cents in the live cattle. Lean hogs at 76.37 and a half, or down $1.40. Outside markets look like this. At the top of the hour, November futures, $81.61 a barrel in the crude oil, up $1.64. Ethanol at $1.91, down 8 4/10 of a cent. Natural gas at $3.79 7/10, 7.5 cents lower. November heating oil or diesel fuel, 2.5 cents higher, $2.29 3/10. And the gold futures at $1,316.10, up $8.30. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now just about 47 points higher at 10,835. And the U.S. dollar at 78.1 is down 0.62 on the afternoon. The CRB index at 285.69, down 1.17. Here's what the weather forecast for the area looks like. Yet this afternoon should remain sunny, high near 74 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy, a low of 49. Tomorrow, partly sunny, high of 63 degrees. North winds between 10 and 16 tomorrow. They'll gust up to 23 miles an hour. And Saturday night, partly cloudy, a low of 36. North winds between 7 and 11. Sunday night, mostly sunny skies. Or Sunday, mostly sunny skies during the day, high of 61. Sunday night, patchy frost after 1 a.m. That's right, frost. Otherwise, should be mostly clear, low around 35 degrees. Monday, it'll be sunny, a high of 64. Monday night, clear, a low of 37. Tuesday, sunny, and a high of 67 degrees. Tuesday night, it'll be mostly clear, a low of 41. And Wednesday and Thursday, a high of 70 and 73. Sunny on both days, the Wednesday night low, about 48 degrees. A more complete look at the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. And we hear from the Midwestern Regional Climate Center and Steve Hilberg.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. On the phone line with us, as usual, Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. You have your work cut out for you this afternoon. Mike, tell me all about what happened in Chicago today.
You should have said an ugly Friday afternoon, Todd.
Oh, yeah. A lot of red in the marketplace, and farmers will not be happy as they harvest corn. And they look out and see that their corn crop today, compared to last Friday, is worth 56 cents a bushel less than it was.
They probably won't be happy in the short term, but I think this week's trade will do a lot in securing and keeping our demand market intact. I think that's the bright side, and I really feel like that this break was well-timed in terms of the end of the quarter. It looked like to me that the commodity funds started the week off with liquidating and selling. By the end of the week, especially centered around the grain stocks report and centered around the Informa numbers this afternoon at mid-session, that we probably saw an additional push to the downside led by index-related selling or index-related liquidation. Numbers I'm hearing right now is in excess of 40,000 contracts sold in futures and corn just today alone. So between yesterday and today, you're looking at a lot of liquidation, and it fits pretty nicely with the calendar.
Okay, the Informa numbers did come out. They're saying we think it's 158.7 on the crop, but the USDA won't come out with that next week. They'll be at 160.3.
Right. I think the thing that the trade did not like about the Informa numbers in corn was that they probably wanted to see something closer to a 155 or 156 national yield in terms of the implicit final yield. But when Informa came out with a 12.9 billion bushel crop, I think the trade was not prepared for that. And you noticed yesterday we had the beans supporting us, much like we had the beans supporting us earlier this week and all of last week. Well, today it was a different story, and I think there again the Informa number coming out at 44.7 bushels helped to secure the bearish position and to keep the bulls on the sidelines and bring in new sellers. I think also the wet weather in Mato Grosso, the forecast for nearly 5 days of rain next week, also probably added to the negative picture in the beans. It was very interesting to me to see the beans give up in the midst of another, I think, five-month high in the crude oil and another, I think it was a 7 or 8 month low in the dollar index. We're still down about 620 points in the dollar, but the beans ignored those typical things that it follows. It ignored that, and I think that goes back to that weather and goes back to the Informa numbers.
Yeah, the USDA reports are kind of coming fast and furious this year, just a week and a day between yesterday's grain stocks report and Friday of next week, which will be the crop production report. It's actually on the eighth day of the month this year. That's pretty early. Usually that's the 12th, 13th, 14th, something along those lines. But a little later, just as a reminder, currently USDA says 162.5 on the corn crop nationally at a 13.16. Informa's number again. They say USDA will come out with a 160 something or other, but they're looking at a 158.7 with a 12.9 crop in total production. And their 44.7 bushel to the acre is actually the same as what USDA currently has for their soybean harvest on a national yield.
Yeah, and I think that's where, like you said a minute ago, the USDA is probably not going to drop too much on the corn yield. But I think that as we get closer to next Friday's report, I think the Chicago market, especially after this break this week, will maybe come back around and see some additional liquidation pressures Monday, Tuesday, maybe even Wednesday of next week if we don't get good export inspections on Monday morning. But as we get closer to the report, I think that the trade after the grain stocks report is left with the idea, well, did the USDA add 300 million bushels to the September 1 corn stocks number so that they could take away 300 million bushels because of a lower yield or an increase in demand? And so I think you'll see the market tighten up quite a bit as we get to the middle part of next week, and I especially look for the wheat to do that because we hit really close to that major support in the Dease wheat or the lead month wheat in Chicago right around that 645 level with today's low of 646.5. That's a very, very solid number from a standpoint of attracting global wheat demand. And in fact, after the close I saw a report by from the Newswires that we're looking at maybe Egypt tendering for early December shipments that was just released after the close today. So I think our prices in wheat are getting low enough. We should attract the demand again. And if we find a bottom by Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday in wheat, I think the corn will find some support as well. And I probably will come in and buy some corn before the report on Friday morning as a result of that.
Okay, I know that you and Dave Dickey and I and everybody else have been looking at all kinds of numbers just for fun. You mentioned, you mentioned the 162.5. I did too. That was the last time USDA came out with a crop production report, was on the 10th day. And when USDA took the 300 million bushels, put them back in yesterday into the grain stocks report, that made what happened on September the 10th during the crop production report, when it did that 300 million bushels disappeared, show back up, relatively speaking. So if you go back to the 9th day of December, or I'm sorry, the 9th day of September in the December contracts, and we had a 1.7 billion bushel corn carryout, and a 1.4 this year and a 1.4 for next year. We've traded at 457.25 on that day this year in the December, or today in December corn. For next year, we were at 160.75, and we were at 470.75 on September the 9th for December corn this year. And we this year are today at 465.75, so not so terribly different. Fibonacci numbers, we settled on one of those today, and about a third retracement. And then I pulled up did you go back and look at this in the harvest month for December contract? I pulled that up and looked at the weekly, and the last high, relatively speaking, after we came off the big jump in December corn futures in 2009 was the same as the close for today.
Yeah, and you know, you notice also the January 11th high on the December weekly chart, December futures only weekly chart on the composite, is right around 450. So we've got a ton of congestion between the 450 and this 465 level. And I think all I need is the wheat to show me a bottom. And at that point, I think the technicals can take over in the corn. Now, having said that, I think it's really important to put a marker out here, Todd. We did lose the three-month-old trendline support levels in both the Dow Jones UBS Grain Index and also the S&P Goldman Sachs Agriculture Index. Those sub-indexes that trade only agricultural commodities, we did lose a three-month support line on that, and so we did hit a technical level that could continue to initiate more liquidation by index funds. And so that's why I'm going to be very, very nervous about buying any corn until a wheat bottom is in place, because if a wheat bottom gets in place, then I can start to say, okay, our demand's coming back, and also wheat being the most globally sensitive commodity at this point, it coming back around gives me a little bit more strength and sentiment that maybe the index funds won't want to let go of any more at this time.
Oh, Mike, I give you all the ammunition for congestion, and you just have to look at something else, didn't you?
but you've been
consistent the whole way through.
The commodity trading funds love congestion, and so what I'm setting up here is a battle between commodity trading funds wanting to get net short and index funds not wanting them to, and the commodity trading funds actually back away from wanting to get net short. A lot of people have called this week and said, is it over? Is it over? Is it over? And I really don't believe that. I think this is a correction, and it's a very healthy correction from the demand standpoint.
Anything that we need to talk about on the soybeans? They weren't down as sharply, but they were down hard.
I would say to you, Todd, and this goes back to the commodity week last week, I am still very nervous about the beans. I'm very nervous from a standpoint of the weather premium already put in. I'm nervous from a standpoint of the demand premium already put in. I'm backing off of trying to sell the beans as a spec because of this unbelievable demand we've seen in China. But that would be the last thing I would buy going into the report, I think. And I think that especially if the United States and China want to ratchet up their trade problems and get a little bit hung up on their currency issues going into this G20 meeting, which is also starts the day of the next Friday's report, I'm very nervous that the Chinese might want to go ahead and cancel some bean shipments. So I'd be very skeptical about being long going into the report on beans.
Hey, thanks much. Appreciate
hey, thanks,
you.
Todd. Have a good weekend.
Hey, you too. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdiffer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Hey, Dave Dickey will be here in a moment. He'll have all the ag news. If you'd like to hear what Mike had to say again, you can do that this evening, this afternoon if you want, not long from now, within the hour, at willag.org. Now, here's Dave.
In agricultural news, a top U.S. Federal Reserve official today says that more action by the U.S. Federal Reserve to boost growth will likely be needed if the economic outlook does not improve. William Dudley, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, says that current conditions of high unemployment and low inflation are unacceptable. Many analysts expect the Fed to start a new round of bond purchases or quantitative easing as soon as its next meeting in early November. Dudley says that $500 billion of purchases would likely have about the same impact as a 5/10 or 3/4 percent point decline in the Fed's benchmark federal funds rate. Meanwhile, Merrill Lynch analysts today say that further quantitative easing by the Fed could push oil prices to an average of $83 next year per barrel, even if demand remains weak. The bank calculated in a global commodity research note that oil prices would increase by 6% if the Fed were to expand the money supply by an additional $500 to $750 billion as early as the first quarter of 2011 in a second round of quantitative easing. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says it will repeat a survey of farmers in the Northern Plains to find out how much wheat, barley, and oats they produced because a harvest was still incomplete during the earlier review. USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service may release updated estimates for acreage, yield, production, and stocks for barley, oats, durum wheat, and other spring wheat in its November crop production report. Previous estimates, included in a small grains summary released yesterday, were based on a sample of producers growing the crops. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization today says that global food prices rose in September, with the FAO Food Price Index climbing for the fourth month in a row and reaching the highest level in 25 months. Food prices are expected to be lower in October, and the FAO says there is no threat of major price spikes until the end of the year. The index, which measures monthly price changes for a food basket composed of cereals, oil seeds, dairy, meat, and sugar, averaged 188.2 points last month, up from an updated 176.9 points in August, and was the highest since August of 2008. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. He'll be back in the second half of our program. We call that The Farming World, and this is the very last day for that program. Today, Dave will talk with Joe Persaki from NASS about yesterday's USDA reports. Now, up next, you know, the early corn harvest across the Midwest should give some farmers an opportunity to relieve compaction in their fields. I'll have more with an agronomist from right here on this campus. It rained a lot last year and this year, too, and the soils at planting weren't in the best condition. Now the corn harvest is moving quickly, and farmers should be thinking about what to do about some of those rutted and compacted areas that have developed over the last 2 years, says University of Illinois agronomist Emerson Nafziger.
We haven't had a chance to do a lot of good fall tillage and good compaction relief, we'll call it, for a few years now, and so people are very interested in doing that. It certainly doesn't mean that we have to go out and deep rip every field, But there are fields where compaction has accumulated. Most of us know where those are or know those places in the field where that is. And I think this fall that would be a good time to try to do that.
Well, in the places that need it. For instance, many ruts were created last fall as combines moved through saturated fields trying to bring in the crop. Compacted soils happen when the air is squeezed out of them, not when the water is moved around. Those ruts, quite likely already filled in and leveled off, probably do not need a deep ripping.
So the mud that we pushed out of those tracks that we made a year ago wasn't compacted, and when we put it back in, it probably functioned more or less like normal soil. However, most fields where we didn't make tracks, we did do compaction, and we weren't able to relieve that this spring. And so a lot of compaction that we created during planting and harvesting in 2009 was still with us in the spring of 2010, and it's still with us today.
With us not 8 inches deep, but something more on the order of 12 to 15 inches below the soil surface. Knapsiger says it'll take a lot of power to reach that deep into the profile, but that it should be worth it. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. By the way, the Illinois agronomist Knapsiger cautions farmers to let the soils dry out for some time this fall before deep ripping. If it's not pulling hard, he says, the soils are still too wet to be working. It's a Friday afternoon. Time to check the cash grain market. Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company is here. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
Well, if they could turn it back a couple of days, they would. That's not possible. So they're dealing today in the field with, about a 56-cent drop from last Friday to this Friday on the board. How has basis handled that drop?
On corn, the basis has improved substantially. We're getting your typical board down, basis up, getting to the tail end of harvest and seeing improvement out there. Nearby, we were at 35 under last Friday, 21 under the D's tonight. So a 14-cent basis improvement. It's not a bad week's move on the basis.
Not too bad at all. And on beans, did you follow same suit or not?
Not really on soybeans. Beans are steady to a couple cents better. The problem on soybeans is the crush margin isn't as good as it's been for the past several months. And beans are acting like there's more of them out there than what the government reports are showing. We're seeing overall some pretty good yield numbers, and bean spaces filled up pretty rapidly. So we're still in an overflow situation on soybeans.
And your expectations for next week?
More of the same probably on corn, at least a little bit, although we've taken a good-sized chunk out of it. We are really wrapping harvest up rapidly here, so we'll be down into the tail end of things next week.
Your bids for the day?
We are at 445 on nearby corn, 1025 on soybeans.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bruce Bostard is with the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. Joins us here on the closing market report on a Friday afternoon. Just as a reminder there, he said his basis had appreciated, closed by 14 cents from last Friday to this Friday. I'll be back in just 2 minutes when we'll take a more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast.
It's Agricultural Fair Day. It's also World Vegetarian Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1795, Robert Bakewell died, an agriculturalist. He helped revolutionize cattle and sheep breeding in England. He obtained the best animals he could find, and then he worked with a closed herd, inbreeding only superior animals. In 1908, the Model T Ford was introduced at a price of $825. Due to efficient mass production, by 1925, the price of a two-door Model T was only $260. In 1913, a monument to honor seagulls was erected in Salt Lake City. The gulls had eaten a plague of grasshoppers that threatened the Mormon settlers' crops in 1848. In 1972, Louis Leakey died, an archaeologist and anthropologist. He was largely responsible for convincing scientists that Africa was the place to search for human origins, not Java or China. And in 1980, European community countries banned the use of hormones in cattle feed. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Here's what the National Weather Service has to say about the forecast for the immediate area in Urbana-Champaign. For the night, should be partly cloudy skies. A low of 49 degrees, 6 to 8 miles an hour for the winds out of the northwest. Tomorrow, partly sunny skies, a high near 63, northwest winds between 10 and 16. They'll gust all the way up to 23. And then tomorrow night, partly cloudy, a low of 36 degrees, winds between 7 and 11 miles an hour. On Sunday, it should be sunny, mostly sunny, that is, a high of 61 degrees. Sunday night, partly cloudy. They'll be actually clear, actually, and some patchy frost. That'll happen after 1 a.m., otherwise mostly clear, and a low around 35 degrees.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
I'm Steve Hilberg with the Midwestern Regional Climate Center located at the Illinois State Water Survey in Champaign. The unusually warm September weather was pushed out of Illinois and the Midwest last weekend as a strong cold front marched through the region. Temperatures this week were several degrees below normal in contrast to the much above normal weather last week. Minimum temperatures reached the low 40s in a number of locations this week, while daytime temperatures struggled to reach the mid and upper 60s on Sunday and Monday, finally pushing over 70 degrees on Tuesday and the rest of the week. Despite the period of very warm weather the middle part of September, temperatures across Illinois will end up just about average in most locations. The period of hot weather was offset by a cool start and a cooler than normal end to the month. The last rain in Illinois was last Saturday night and Sunday when an upper-level system rotated through Illinois. High pressure kept skies sunny and the weather dry the rest of the week. September precipitation will end near to well above normal, generally in the northwestern two-thirds of Illinois, but less than 50% of normal in the far southeast. It looks like the first full week of October should be as nice as the last week of September, so harvest activities should be able to continue without any weather-related interruptions. Temperatures will remain near to below normal until the end of the week, when it may start warming up a bit. For the Midwestern Regional Climate Center in Champaign, I'm Steve Hilberg.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Hey, don't forget to tune in for Commodity Week if you get the opportunity on our flagship station here in Urbana-Champaign. That airs at 6 a.m. and 11:30. But you can always, on Saturday mornings that is, but you can always pick it up off our website at willag.org. Just a quick look at the weekly trades. Corn futures were down 56 cents in the December Friday to Friday this week. Soybeans were down 69 cents on the November contract from Friday to Friday. We'll take a complete look at that during our program called Commodity Week. You can pick it up online at willag.org after 6 p.m. this evening on a Friday afternoon.
You're listening to The Farming World. Our guest today is Joseph Persaki, Director of the Statistics Division of the National Agricultural Statistics Service. Mr. Persaki began his career with NASS in 1984 with stints in the NASS field offices of Tennessee and Indiana. His most recent appointment occurred in 2008. He holds BS and MS degrees in agribusiness economics from SIU Carbondale and an MS in applied statistics from Purdue University. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Dave.
Yesterday, USDA had its quarterly grains stocks report, and it found some 300 million bushels more corn than it had in its June estimate. And so the trade had a lot of difficulty with those numbers, to be honest, because USDA says that no new crop corn made it into the old stock estimates, which left one or two things happening or a combination thereof. Either disappearance slowed, demand slowed, and or more production was found. I know that you don't necessarily, as an organization, keep track of those particularly. But what can you tell us about yesterday's reports that will help it make sense?
Yeah, one thing, I just want to just make a little slight adjustment to your opening comment. Back in June, when NASS published the grain stocks report, we came in about 300 million bushels lower than industry expectations on the total stocks. And then this time, in September, we came in about 300 million above the industry expectation. Mm-hmm. So that's the 300 million bushels I believe you were chatting about earlier. And then you talked about, or you made the comment about no new crop stocks being in this number. When we survey farmers, there's two parts of this. There's a farmer survey that gets us on-farm stocks, and then it's almost, not quite, but it's almost a census of off-farm facilities. We get our off-farm part of this estimate. What we do is, in both cases, on the questionnaires, we specifically point out that we are collecting old crop corn, meaning from the 2009 crop year or earlier on both the on-farm and off-farm side. Now, is it possible that someone just reports what they have in hand, let's say on the on-farm side? Sure, it's possible. But during our editing of the data and our analysis of the data, if we get any records that match back to June and the current stocks are higher than they were in June, that sets off a flag for us. We call it an error or an edit check. We'll go back and look at the data, and we'll look at the operations, and we'll potentially make phone calls back to the operators. Because if it's, say, a cattle operation or a hog operation, there's a good chance that stocks could be higher, but we'll verify that. So we go the extra mile to make sure it makes sense. And we have between 50 and 75% of the sample between June and September that overlap for that on-farm side. So we go through the efforts there on the on-farm side, and then this time we ended up with that 485 million bushels on farm.
So when you look at it at the end of the day and begin to crunch the numbers, you look at the three legs of demand: ethanol, exports, and livestock. The trade has a pretty good handle on parts of that, exports particularly, although we don't know the variance between the official census numbers and USDA's weekly export numbers just yet. That's a little bit later this month. Regarding ethanol, the trade has a fairly good handle on that, they believe. So you're left, if it's on a slowdown in the disappearance side, with livestock, and What the trade can't put a pencil to is about a 16% cut in livestock feeding.
Right, and I had chatted with the folks in the World Agriculture Outlook Board. That's the folks who put the balance sheet together. We went through these discussions, yesterday morning, when we were in lockup. And, they expressed the same concern. I mean, they said right away, it's like there's going to be a lot of interest in this report. And the only thing I can say is, here are the data. This is what was collected. We look at it. We go through it. And we publish it. I mean, I don't have any vested interest, financially one way or the other on this. I just want to put out the best number I can.
So is there any explanation that makes sense? Because the trade wants when they get their numbers, they want the facts behind them to justify their existence, and they want to NASS or whatever part of USDA, be it WASD, to be able to come and say, these are the reasons that these numbers exist. And I think one of the things that the trade has been saying, at least have been saying to me in the last day or two, is whether or not it would be a good idea to go ahead and split up residual and feed numbers.
Now that would be on the World Board to split up the residual and feed numbers. And that's something that you could talk with them about. But that I've heard that as well, because really you're right. You're exactly right, because that is feed and residual. And basically, if you go through the balance sheet, that's one. It's basically a calculation. Here it is, because you're absolutely correct. The guys in the World Board, they can go through and get the ethanol. They can get the exports. And then there's a little bit of other use in there as well. And then what's left over, that's a calculated number. And that is feed and residual. It's different than with soybeans, because soybeans, it's either you crush it or you export soybeans. So it's a different picture with soybeans.
You mentioned that the September 1 corn stocks number was 301 million bushels above the average trade estimate. The 30 June quarterly stocks report was 288 million bushels below the average trade estimate. So that sort of begs the question, what happened in the June report?
And I've heard that before, and that's one that I'm, I've been kind of scratching my head about, and I've asked several, people in the trade, the question about, well, how much grain was in transit in June, because we don't count the grain in transit. It's actually when it gets someplace. Well, if you do the math on that, it doesn't account for all of it. And I don't have an answer on that. But I do know that if you look at the balance sheet on an annual basis and a six-month basis, going from last year to this year on an annual, and then going from March to now on a six-month basis, it doesn't look too bad. I know we shocked the system yesterday, but overall, it doesn't look too bad.
Well, I also know that USDA revised the 1 June stocks figure slightly lower in the current report, so they found something.
Well, now, generally, if we have a revision, we're in September, we revise June, it's either that we get, I use the term the word late report, that we get a report from someone beyond the time frame, the data collection time frame in June, because there's operations that we have to estimate for if we don't get a response. And so in this case, we got a report from an entity, and we were able to use that rather than the estimated report on that. So that's generally where those revisions come from in the interim, in June in this case.
After going through the last 48 hours and talking to many in the trade, talking to many reporters, beginning to get an understanding about what happened regarding the report, is there talk and room for future considerations to do this a little bit better? And if so, what might some of those aspects look like?
Yeah, there's always room. Yeah, that's a good point, Dave. There's always room for improvement in what we do. And, after this is what, I'll get with my staff, and we're going to sit down and think, okay, let's talk about our analysis procedures, what we do in headquarters, and we'll touch base again. We'll touch base with our field offices. Okay, guys, remember this is important what we do, and go through this whole process again and just make sure that we're doing everything correct. I feel today that we are doing things correctly, but it's always good to do a review from on what we do. And then plus, you know, it's good to, you know, to discuss this, you know, with other folks too on the outside, because I've been very busy the last few days. Well, not the last few days, the last few hours since about 8:30 yesterday morning, you know, with different folks. What exactly do you do and such? But it's a process that we go through.
Is there something that jumps out that's obvious to you? Might the reports, the questions, the way they're asked? I know that a lot of care is taken in making sure that we're only talking about old stocks, but might that have to be revisited?
Oh, sure. Everything is always open for discussion in with us, because we always try to keep abreast of things. And we are looking at different ways to, you know, collect data, you know, mainly, you know, with either different types of personal enumeration tools, and it may be doing a little bit different the way we do collect our data by phone, but just to keep abreast of changes. And, you know, and I know things, you know, like on the farm, you know, it's, you know, farmers are busy and such, and we want to try to make it as convenient as possible for them to report.
The reason I bring that up is I wonder if new crop corn, which is fed or exported prior to 1 September, looks to the producer like old crop use.
Yeah, and I don't have a good comment on that one, Dave. That one, because we talked about that with Jerry Norton. I chatted a little bit about that, about the new crop consumption. What happened with it? You know, if it was already used, you know, in the old one. And I don't have a good feel on that. That's kind of outside of my expertise.
What other things are you hearing from the trade regarding these reports that has some justification in your mind?
Just like the things you commented potentially about, you know, like the ethanol plants maybe, you know, buying new crop corn, you know, and foregoing old crop purchases in their regional, you know, in their areas, which could, you know, could explain some of that. Were they knowing that the yields from the ethanol yields from the new crop corn, you know, may be better than the old crop corn? And then some of this idea that there's quite a bit of corn sitting on barges down in the Gulf, and that's counted as stocks on hand down there waiting for new crop to come in to blend through. I mean, that's the things I hear. So a lot of people, and, you know, we're looking at things, yeah.
And the truth is, and the matter is, we really won't quite know what occurred yesterday until the January reports come out, yes?
That's a fair statement, Dave. That's a fair statement to make.
Thank you for being with us today, Joe.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Dave.
That's Joe Persaki, Director of the National Agricultural Statistics Service in Washington, D.C. You've been listening to The Farming World.
Leonard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Leonard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Leonard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
The Farming World is coming to an end on the first day of October after a six-month run. We thank you for your support, and we look forward to the advancement of our core mission, distributing regionally, nationally, and internationally information and analysis of commodity markets and agricultural weather. When the situation warrants, you can rest assured we'll follow key agricultural topics and stories, and we'll make room for discussions with those that influence the political spectrum of agriculture in the closing market report, which remains in its traditional 206 to 236 time slot. Again, thank you for your support as we wrap up The Farming World.
It's Agricultural Fair Day. It's also World Vegetarian Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1795, Robert Bakewell died. An agriculturalist, he helped revolutionize cattle and sheep breeding in England. He obtained the best animals he could find, and then he worked with a closed herd, inbreeding only superior animals. In 1908, the Model T Ford was introduced at a price of $825. Due to efficient mass production, by 1925, the price of a two-door Model T was only $260. In 1913, a monument to honor seagulls was erected in Salt Lake City. The gulls had eaten a plague of grasshoppers that threatened the Mormon settlers' crops in 1848. In 1972, Louis Leakey died, an archaeologist and anthropologist. He was largely responsible for convincing scientists that Africa was the place to search for human origins, not Java or China. And in 1980, European community countries banned the use of hormones in cattle feed. And that's this day in agricultural history. This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Coming up next, Farm Fresh. Who doesn't like the idea of farm-to-plate with as few steps in between as possible? Certainly not the consumer, but the home buyer is not alone in their desire for direct-from-farm food, as Lisa Brautz discovers in her latest edition of In My Backyard.
The next few weeks are the peakest of the peak season for fresh food in our part of Illinois. I find it glorious this time of year to just keep pulling fresh food out of the garden and making something simple for dinner out of it. It's awesome for me to go to our local farmers markets, too, and choose from the many, many fresh fruits and vegetables that I don't grow and make something simple for dinner. Or complicated. It depends. It's also wonderful to be able to go to a couple of smaller local grocery stores here in town and expect to see Illinois-grown produce there, just in case I run out of something. I'm not the only person. When people see locally grown fruits and vegetables, and meat, cheese, and eggs, too, especially if there's information about where and how it was grown, they're interested in eating them regularly. Just ask the folks in charge at your local small natural foods grocers which department is growing the fastest. I'll bet it's the local produce. There's demand. There is definitely demand. But what about those times when you don't feel like getting dinner going? When you would just rather leave the whole enterprise, especially the dishes, to someone else, but you also want to support local growers while you're taking the night or day or morning off? Getting local food into restaurants is kind of a final food frontier. I'm not even talking about chain restaurants, since their choices in food sourcing aren't necessarily dictated by people who are even in the same country as the restaurant, never mind the same town. Even mom-and-pop restaurants, the bistros and cafes and delis that make our food scene unique, getting local food into these places has never been easy, but it's gotten a lot easier over time. I did some investigating. More and more restaurants all over the United States are starting to source their food, we're talking fresh produce, meat, cheese, and eggs, from local growers. Some places have been doing it for a while. California, for example, has a long list of restaurants who've been sourcing food from local farmers since the 70s. Large cities like New York and Chicago do whatever it takes to bring in food from the surrounding rural areas and farmers markets. Looking at smaller cities, I saw that Middlebury, Vermont has one of the ultimate local food diners, the aptly named Farmer's Diner. Asheville and Durham, North Carolina have vibrant local food cultures that include eateries from fine dining to breakfast joints, focusing on local food. We're starting to see more of it here. I wandered into Black Dog on a recent Saturday afternoon. It was packed. The Urbana restaurant is well known in CU for its take on smoked meats and barbecue. The restaurant has been open for about a year and a half, and while they toyed with locally sourced food in the past, co-owner Mike Cochran has recently been taking steps to add more local food to the menu.
Well, we've gotten a little bit better at it. Been able to make some more contacts, some of them through the farmers market, some of them just finding other farmers and other farmers finding us, and just some through the people that we know. So it's improved. It's something that we want to do more of, and there's been a good reception for it. So I think we'll be able to continue doing it.
Mike's responsiveness to customer demand has, in turn, created more demand, which has its ups and downs. On the downside, the farm in Sydney supplying Black Dog with chickens can't keep up, he told me. Fear of not being able to get what they need when they need it is high on the list of restaurateur fears. On the upside, while the sourcing of local ingredients has resulted in a few nominal price hikes on the menu, it hasn't been that big of a deal.
And then for price, it's, you know, I guess a lot of restaurant people figure out things by percentage. So, you know, the investment that you put in and you try to get a percentage, keep your costs at a certain percentage. We have to change that when we do the local food. We do pass along some costs to the consumer, but we try not to raise the price too much. And basically, we just try not to make any less money than we are making on the conventional products. So we don't get the percentage return on our investment, because the investment's significantly more, sometimes up to 4 or 5 times the cost of what we pay right now. But it is worthwhile. The products are much better. I think people enjoy them better, and I think it's I just think it's the right way to go.
One thing I can say for sure, the lines there have been as long as ever, maybe longer. Procuring food from local sources isn't as easy as a farmer walking into a restaurant or a chef walking onto a farm. Distribution, getting the food from the farmer to the chef, is a perpetual problem. The folks at Stewards of the Land, a collective of family farms in or near Fairbury, Illinois, work together to supply restaurants and small grocers in Illinois with a truly awesome variety of locally grown foods. They supply high-end restaurants like Baccaro in Champaign and Frontera Grill in Chicago, as well as some small fry like Dave's Supermarket in Fairbury. And the Stewards have all the business they can handle. Several farms in the Urbana-Champaign area supply a few restaurants with local food in season. One of those farms is Blue Moon Farm, a certified organic produce farm located in rural Urbana. Their farm manager, Lorian Carsey, sends out an email to between 4 and 8 restaurant food purchasers twice a week to let them know what's available, and the farm makes their deliveries accordingly. Lorian thinks the increase in local food in CU restaurants in recent years is encouraging, but there is definitely more to do. We talked the other day after the farmer's market, and she told me, "We'd love to sell more of what we grow to the restaurants we're already selling to, and we'd love to sell to more restaurants in general." Local food from local farmers. It's good for the restaurants, it's good for the farms, and it's good for we eaters. Demand at the farmer's market can translate into demand at local restaurant tables, but it'll happen faster if we ask. So belly up to the table and let them know. You might be out for dinner, but you want to keep it local.
Lisa Brott's stories can also be heard on our website, WILLAG.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can also read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com.